And if you would, turn in your Bibles to Luke chapter 6. Matthew, Mark, Luke in the New Testament. We're finally back to Luke after a 7-week break. Didn't intend for it to be quite that long, but we had a couple weeks of Christmas messages, a couple of New Year's messages, a couple of necessary messages on the body, the church, what it means that we're together. And then Barry preached for us last week. Barry Lawrence was here, and now we're back to Luke. As we take another chunk of Luke chapter 6, the topic for us this morning is to judge or not to judge. What is good judgment? What is bad judgment? There are four things I want us to examine in this next section of Luke, and they'll be up on the screen, so you don't need to write them down now, but I'll give you a heads up. Four words: exhortation, imitation, illustration, and motivation. The first, exhortation. It's an exhortation to mercy and grace that starts us off. Look at verse 36. Be merciful just as your Father is merciful. An exhortation here, a commandment to be merciful. The next commandment, verse 37, do not judge and you will not be judged. Do not condemn and you'll not be condemned. Pardon and you will be pardoned. A third category here for exhortation or command is verse 38, give and it will be given to you. They will pour into your lap a good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over. For by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you in return. Well, don't forget the previous context, which probably easy to do, even if you were here 7 weeks ago when we were in Luke 6 last, but look just in your Bibles to see what's going on here in the previous verses. Remember in verse 20, Jesus gathered the disciples and began teaching and started with the Beatitudes, the statements of blessing, the sayings of blessing. But then you get to verse 27 and you see, it says, I say to you who hear, love your enemies and do good to those who even hate you. Bless them who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. He applies it in verse 30 like this, give to everyone who asks of you. Or in verse 32, he points it in this direction. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. In verse 34, lend to those who you don't expect any payment back from. Verse 35, love your enemies and do good. Lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you'll be sons of the Most High, for He Himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. So because we're picking up in the middle of a speech, you could say, we're using verse 36 as kind of a summary today of what Jesus has said before. The summary of what he's already said, verses 27 to basically verse 36, is this: be merciful just as your Father is merciful. He wants his disciples to show the world that they operate on a different kind of ethic. He wants them to show their enemies what God's love is like. His love is like this: it's completely undeserved. He loves his enemies. He doesn't love those who just do good to him, or else none of us would have hope. Notice verse 38, give and it will be given to you. I've heard this used many times in reference to giving, financial giving. Give and it will come back to you. Not just the weird preachers on TV who talk about, you know, a faith seed gift where you put it in the ground and it comes back and sprouts up. And it's not just the heretics, to put it bluntly, who use a verse like this to think that you give financially and it will come back to you even greater than when you gave it. But this passage is not talking about money so much in that there's a monetary return. Remember, the whole context is give to those who can't give to you. You're going to give to people who can't give to you. If you lend to people who will repay you, well, you can start a bank. That's fine. Banks do that. There's nothing godly about loaning money out to get more money back. But if you lend to those who don't have any money to pay you back, if you lend without any expectation about getting money back, then you give and your eternal reward will be, verse 38, pressed down, shaken together, running over. The standard measure by which you give, it will be given to you in heaven. It's like what Peter asked. He reminded Jesus in, I think it's Luke 18. Jesus, we have left everything for you. On one level, that's true. They had. Remember, they had left their fishing gear, their fishing boats, their fishing business. They probably left family and houses. They left things and followed Jesus. But Jesus' response to Peter is, oh, you haven't left anything in relation to what you'll get in the next life, in your eternal reward. You've left homes? Are you kidding? What kind of home you'll have in heaven? You've left family? Are you kidding? You know what kind of family you'll have in heaven? It's that kind of thing that I think verse 38 is talking about here. Not a financial promise. Give and don't worry, it'll come back more to you. No, give and you'll probably lose money. But that shows you the priority of the Christian heart, of discipleship. You give without thought merely of tomorrow. You give in light of eternity. That's the exhortation. Mercy, forgiveness, giving. Now, secondly, the imitation. There's an imitation being talked about here. Be careful who you follow in the next couple verses. Verse 39, he spoke a parable to them. A blind man cannot guide a blind man, can he? Will they not both fall into a pit? A pupil is not above his teacher, but everyone, after he's been fully trained, will be like his teacher. The context of this sermon that Jesus is giving is not only that he's pointing out true religion versus false religion, it's that the false religion he's referring to throughout this passage is pointedly that of the Pharisees. He's critiquing Pharisaical righteousness. The Pharisees of Jesus' day were the righteous ones, the so-called righteous ones. As Jesus uses words like righteous, his hearers would think, oh, you mean like the Pharisees, the real righteous ones. They looked righteous. They acted righteous. They said what was and was not righteous. Jesus is pointing out in this sermon and elsewhere, that is not it. The Pharisees are not good leaders as regards mercy, as regards giving. Where they give, they don't give except for to earn points with God. They judge all right, but they will be judged. Jesus is saying the Pharisees are hypocritical, self-righteous, religious, and yet damned. They're blind, so don't follow them. Don't follow them despite the fact that they call themselves leaders, despite the fact that they're acknowledged to be leaders. It's a case of the blind leading the blind. And so Jesus here shows us the inevitability of influence. Look at verse 40 again. Pupil's not above his teacher. Everyone, after he has been fully trained by that teacher, will be like his teacher. The teacher does rub off. If you don't like the teacher and you purpose not to be like the teacher, chances are you find a new teacher. But I bet if you are at least tolerant even of the teacher, you begin to be like the teacher. You begin to think like the teacher. You begin maybe even to say things like the teacher. I know there are pastors and preachers better than I who've influenced me greatly. And I've said before, I'm always surprised to hear them preach and to find out that, you know, something I've said for years, I actually got from D.A. Carson. I didn't come up with it. I thought I did, but then he comes to our church and preaches, and I think, ooh, I said a lot of that to this church already. I didn't know I got it from him, but I guess I did. It wore off on me, and it kind of melds together what's my own and what's that of the teacher. So if you're in a church for a long time, a lot of the things you say will be things other people in our church say. A lot of the verses that get quoted around here often will rub off on you as getting quoted and thought about often. Be careful who you choose as a leader. Don't be like the Pharisees. They're hypercritical, self-righteous, religious, and they're damned, and they will lead you into a pit. Thirdly, illustration. There's an illustration here of hypocritical judgment. Remember, he's just talked about the blind leading the blind. He's referring to the Pharisees, the righteous leaders of the day who really aren't good leaders whatsoever. And the key that he's focusing on is that of judgment. Look at verse 37 to see the principle. The principle, do not judge, and you'll not be judged. And then, here's the illustration, verse 41. Why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, "Brother, let me take out that speck that's in your eye," when you yourself do not see the log that is in your own eye? You hypocrite. First, take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take out the speck that is in your brother's eye. Well, we're going to camp out on these two verses and on this concept of what judging is. To judge or not to judge, that is the question for us this morning. Now, don't miss what Jesus is saying. I think it's pretty obvious, but in case it's not, the thing in the eye is sin. The eye is a symbol for the whole soul, the actions, body, spirit, the whole person. So you can see sin, you could say, in another person and say, "Hey, that's an error, let me help you." But there are small sins and big sins. And there's a hypocrisy. "You hypocrite," he says. There's a hypocrisy about ignoring a log stuck in your eye socket while you're helping someone pick at a piece of sawdust that got into your eye. The Greek word for speck here, it could be anything that's small and dry. It could be sawdust, it could be a splinter. You can't help but think that maybe Jesus' background in carpentry is coming from this, is rooted in this illustration here. He's thinking of the many times he did this in the shop and got something in his eye and knew the big difference between getting something in your eye and whatever the equivalent was of the table saw kicking back and poof, you get hit with a piece of wood. That happened with my chop saw last week. Went down, cutting a rough piece of wood, dull blade, boom, I got hit. My wife doesn't know that till just now. It didn't hurt. And I was wearing my safety glasses. But it made me think of this passage of log in the eye. Think of how absurd this picture is. It's purposely funny. There are all kinds of people before Jesus, thinkers, philosophers, who said things like this. They said things like, "No one should critique others who's not willing to first critique himself." They talked about hypocrisy, of pointing things out in others who, when you're not willing to point out the same thing and deal with the same things in yourself. Aristotle talked about it long before Jesus. Jesus is the first guy, it seems to me, based on what I found this week, that puts it in this humorous, absurd analogy of a guy with, in our equivalent, a 2x4 stuck in his eye socket. Just go ahead. I wanted to find a good picture of this, gruesome as it was probably going to be, except I couldn't find anything but silly cartoons, and that didn't do the job for me. I wanted something gruesome. Tried to find a guy with a 2x4 in his eye. But can you just try to picture that for a second? I couldn't find it on the web. If you find one, let me know. I'm interested. But picture that with blood and broken bones and this thing stuck in his eye. Imagine him going into an emergency room and seeing someone in the waiting room doing this. They've got something in their eye. It's evident they have something in their eye they're trying to clean out. And he walks over, 2x4 and all, and says, "Oh, let me help you here. You got a little something in your eye? I'm one of the doctors on call here. Why don't you come back to one of the rooms and I'll get a very small tweezers and some saline solution and help you with that small splinter you have in your eye." It's absurd. Even humorous. Jesus takes the ethical principle that Aristotle and others had said, and he makes it funny. And yet, the whole point of the absurdity is itself a point. He's not just being funny to be funny. He's not just using an illustration that's itself helpful and then throwing in a little bit of humor. I do that on accident, week to week. You know, you have an illustration, but you also tell funny parts of the story that have nothing to do with the illustration. Jesus is not doing that. He's smarter than me. Jesus is using the absurdity of the illustration to show how absurd it is when we are hypocritically judging others. It's just like a log stuck in your eye trying to help someone with a little bit of sawdust in theirs. He's mocking hypocrisy then. Don't let the humor lose the impact on you. He's mocking hypocrisy and the hypocrisy that we all should know all too well. That kind of hypocrisy where we can see the faults in others far better than we can see ourselves. Maybe a true biblical story of this kind of thing in Jesus' parable is that of David's sin. Remember, he sees Bathsheba. It's not his wife. He has wives. But he sees someone else's wife bathing, and he likes it, and he calls for her, and they have sex, and she becomes pregnant. And so David brings Uriah home. Maybe her husband will sleep with her, and then he'll think the baby is his, and everything will be fine, and the sin will be covered up. But no, Uriah won't sleep with him, and so now there's a bigger problem. And so he puts Uriah, you know, on the front line, and has him killed in battle. Adultery. Murder. It goes on for some time where David covers and thinks that he's okay. Uriah's gone. Forever, for all anyone else knows, the baby is Uriah's and not David's. But Nathan the prophet knows better. Nathan comes to David, and because it's kind of dicey to rebuke a king, he paints the picture, an analogy, and says that there's, let's say, a poor man with only one sheep, a poor farmer, but then there's this rich farmer who has all these sheep, and the rich farmer goes and takes the one sheep from the little farmer and makes that his meal. And David is furious. David says, who is the man? Like, he's going to get him. It's going to be it. It's going to be serious. It's going to be quick. It's going to be severe. Nathan says, you, O king, are the man. You see the hypocrisy of David's anger at this story. If it were true, this story of a rich farmer taking the one sheep from a poor farmer, that's a speck on the kingdom compared to the log in the eye of the kingdom when its king is adulterous and murderous and lying. A perfect illustration of what Jesus is talking about here. But yet, in our day today, it's so overused, this statement, do not judge. Matthew 7:1, where these same words are used. The same as Luke 6:37, do not judge and you will not be judged. These are the most frequently quoted verses in the Bible in America today. More than John 3:16. More people know John 3:16 as a reference, because some guy is always holding it up at a ballpark. But more people, maybe because it's shorter, but probably because it's more convenient, they know this phrase, do not judge. Do not judge, lest you be judged. It's so misunderstood and so overused today. One way, maybe even in the church, it's overused or misused, as if we were to think that non-judgment is the way to earn God's mercy. Remember verse 37, it says, do not judge and you will not be judged. But like, be merciful and you'll receive mercy. Do not judge is what springs from. It's the fruit that flows from one who already knows his judgment has been paid for in Jesus. You can't get the cart before the horse here and think that you are merciful to others, and therefore God will be merciful to you. Because what you've done then is earn mercy. It might sound like Luke 6:37 is saying that don't judge, you won't be judged by God. But instead, if that were true, we would have to totally redefine mercy and judgment. You can't earn his mercy. It's a contradiction of terms. That's one way it's misunderstood, but usually it's not in reference to God much at all. It's just claimed kind of out of thin air, maybe misunderstood in other ways. Let me go through several ways this statement, do not judge, is misunderstood. When it suggests complete and utter tolerance, the refusal to condemn or even discern anything at all. When it assumes that all paths are equally the same, all religious paths, all paths in pursuit of truth are the same and not one is better than another. When it's used as a blanket statement for any and all judgment whatsoever. Tolstoy, the Russian novelist, thought that Jesus was saying here, courts and governments should be no more. Well, no one has thought that since or before, but at least he's consistent. You see, if we're consistent with this idea that you can just say, do not judge, and it means no one can judge, then what about Hitler? Is Hitler wrong? Is Hitler evil? Is there such a thing as sin happening in the Second World War? What about Stalin? What about Pol Pot in Cambodia? And further, if we're consistent and there is no judging to be done, especially by Christians, then no Christian can even say that one thing is better than another, not just that one thing is wrong and another is right. Of course, no one is consistent like this, except Tolstoy. No one is consistent with this, which only shows that it's probably convenience which drives a lot of people quoting this verse. Or maybe closer to home, maybe closer to the church, is when this verse is quoted because we want to dodge confrontation of sin. Maybe do not judge is misunderstood when it's called upon as a defense for our sin. Don't judge me. Who are you to judge me? Can't be a convenient way. It can be a convenient way, rather, to try to dodge what is right and what is fair and even what is loving confrontation. This passage cannot be forbidding all judgment. Let me give a few reasons why this passage is not forbidding all judgment. Other parts of the Bible call us to be discerning, to judge, to decide between good and evil, to decide between better things and not so good things, worse things. Other parts of the Bible tell us to confront sin in others. Matthew 18 and 1 Corinthians 5 are two, if you want to just look at two passages that talk about it. There are more. The Bible tells us in the church, we are in this thing together, and at times it needs to get serious enough for others to help us see our own sin and fight that sin. Paul often named names in his confrontation and rebuke. Read 1 and 2 Timothy, where he calls out a couple of hoodlums in the church who are causing trouble and teaching false doctrine. In Romans 16, he said, to mark those who cause division and have nothing to do with them. Well, didn't he read Jesus? Paul, Jesus said, don't judge. Don't judge. Oh, he judged. He judged big time. The passage itself, though, not just Paul, not just Jesus in other places, but the passage itself tells us to judge. Remember, you're supposed to judge between who's a good leader and who's a bad leader. That's in verse 39. You don't want a blind leader. You don't want a bad teacher. You'll follow him right into a pit. That takes judgment. That takes discernment. That takes testing to see which is better, which is right, which is wrong. In the Matthew 7 passage, where Jesus says this same thing, do not judge lest you be judged, and then gives the same parable about the wood in the eye, the speck that's in the brother's eye, right after that, Jesus says these judgmental words. Do not cast your pearls before swine. Do not give what is holy to dogs. Jesus judged. Jesus judged big time. Right after he said, don't judge. You say, well, that's because he's Jesus. He can judge. Yeah, but that's not the point. He's telling us to decide who's a swine and who's a dog. And don't waste your time on them. That's tough to know sometimes, but he's telling us there is that category. Later on in the chapter, he tells us to watch out for wolves who would come in sheep's clothing. To say that someone's a wolf in a sheep's clothing would be to judge. And One more reason why this passage is not forbidding all kind of judgment. Matthew 7 and Luke 6 tell this parable to, yes, expose hypocritical judgment, but also to highlight the need for brotherly help. We'll get back to this, but look at verse 42, the second half of it, so you see it now and we can tuck it away. The second half of verse 42, first take the log out of your own eye. Why? Then you will see clearly to take out the speck that is in your brother's eye. First reason to take it out is hypocrisy. Don't walk around with a log in your eye and tell others they have a speck. The second reason is without the log in your eye, you can actually now help somebody. You can now actually help your brother. So what does this mean? What is this command? Do not judge and you'll not be judged. What is it warning us of? Well, one way to answer that question would be to go through all the ways in the New Testament judgment can be bad. I'm going to give them to you. Not all the references, but I'll give you all the principles. So this will take a while. Just get comfy. There are several of these. When is judgment wrong? When are we sinning against Luke 6, 37, do not judge? When we judge motives. When we presume to know what's in people's hearts and what their intentions were. It's on the front of your bulletin this morning, Paul in 1 Corinthians 4 saying, you're judging my motives, you Corinthians, but you don't know my heart. You don't know why I did what I did. You're presuming to know, but you don't. I don't even know, Paul says. I think I know. I think I know that my motives were pure, but I could be wrong. I could be deceived, and I'll really not know until the time I stand before the Lord whether that was pure or whether it was impure, whether it was serving others or whether it seemed to serve others but really served self. Don't judge motives. Another one is when we're ready to pounce on someone without knowing all the facts, we judge them wrongly. Maybe they seem to be wrong, but more information would clearly show us that they're not. Or another one, when that judgment presumes to be final judgment, when it presumes to be salvation judgment, that person's not saved. Oh, that person is saved. Now, I know this passage will go on to say you can know a tree by its fruit. A good tree bears good fruit. Bad tree bears bad fruit. Yeah. But it gets complicated because it's not so black and white, right? There are shades of good, bad trees. We all, the best of our trees, best of our Christian lives, have fake fruit. We try to make it look real, but it's that fake stuff that's sitting on the center of the table in the furniture store. It's not real. It's plastic. And we got all kinds of plastic fruit. And some of us maybe are pretty wise about saying, four plastic fruits, and it's not a real tree. We're a mixed tree sometimes. It's complicated. Be careful that your judgment of another does not presume to be final judgment that only the Lord can give. Another, when it's blatantly hypocritical judgment, maybe it's the sin of the same kind. You know, his speck is small, yours is big. It's the same kind of wood. But you don't see that you have a log in your eye, a 2x4 stuck in your skull. I know that's hard to believe. But imagine you don't have the other eye. If a 2x4 is stuck in your eye, you don't see. And Jesus hints at that in these verses. He says, take it out so you can see. Implication, with it in, you weren't seeing. You weren't seeing yourself. Be careful, you may not be seeing them. All right. You've got a log in your eye, dude. It's possible your vision's off. It's possible you're not seeing straight. It's possible your brain isn't working if that 2x4 went in far enough. Or maybe it's this, that we have our sin and they have theirs, but theirs is more serious. Maybe it's more serious because it's more public. So we want to emphasize their public sin is serious. And since no one knows about my private sin, well, let's just keep it private. That could be a log in your eye. Or maybe, Maybe it's this kind of thing where it's a judgment of someone based purely on doctrine, and it allows you to be content with serious moral failure in your life. Maybe you're a theological jockey. You know, you're sharp. You read theology books. But you also surf the internet in places you shouldn't. Be careful, friend, about the way you impugn others, whether on the web or face-to-face or behind their back. It's possible to have a log jammed into your eye while you're pointing out their theological specs. Maybe we elevate the importance of our strengths and then vilify the sins with which we seem to have a modicum of victory. You know what I mean? Bible reading is everything. And anyone who's not reading their Bibles regularly probably isn't a Christian. How's your Bible reading going? Oh, great, of course. That's why I said that. Ever since it's been good, I've been thinking that you must be a Christian if you're reading the Bible frequently, and if you're not, then you must not be a Christian. Well, what we've done is we've elevated our successes as the mark by which we stand or fall with the Lord, and then we've shined the light on those failures that others are doing, and we say, oh, brother, no. Could be a log in your eye, friend. When the goal is ridiculing their spec instead of trying to help their spec, that's wrong judgment. Whenever it's an exercise of superiority, you see, we get it wrong when we view ourselves wrongly and when we view others wrongly. If we don't view ourselves as fellow sinners, then whether I'm better at one thing or another in the Christian life, I've elevated myself to a superior level and then said, oh, let me help you with that speck. I'm sure you're just slow and just blind and your senses are just dull, and that's why you don't even know there's a splinter stuck in your eyeball. Oh, but I'm so wise and I can help you. Let me do it. If it's not done with an attitude of serving and instead it's done one of superiority, then that's judging wrong. And the outcome will probably be conflict instead of consecration. Maybe we sometimes point out the speck in their eye as part of the penance that we think they deserve. I don't know if they feel bad enough about that sin. I'll help them. Well, that might be a log in your own eye. Or if we go to others about their speck. Did you hear that Jim has lots of wood in his eye? He didn't even know it. He doesn't even wear safety glasses. Bad. When it's just nitpicking. Do you know where that phrase nitpicking comes from? I didn't know until I was 18 and my sister, 8 years younger than me, got lice. Nits are baby lice or lice eggs or something that stick to your hair. Oh, we were, as a family, in between houses living in a hotel when our whole family got lice. My mom used to pick our nits out of our hair like monkeys trying to clean each other. And when it's lice, let's get them out. I think that's a good idea, right? Let's not keep this going and keep spreading to all of our friends and family. But when it's just dandruff, I remember saying to my mom, it's dandruff, come on. And some of you nitpick others like that. Oh, let me help you with that. It's just nitpicking. If it's just about preference, if it's just about how to apply Bible principles instead of the Bible principles themselves, if it's just about disputable matters, you listen to that music, I listen to different music. You're offended by rock and roll, and I'm not. We all have perhaps different ways that we will discern what's appropriate to watch on TV or whether to have a TV. But the Bible's not giving us a commandment about that. It's giving us principles that each of us will apply in different ways. In 1 Corinthians 8 and in Romans 16, spell this out in a lot of detail, that we just need to chill out about those things that are the application of biblical principles instead of instead of the biblical principles themselves. So in a church, sometimes what happens is we judge people who don't look just like us. They don't parent just like us. Their kids don't dress just like us. Oh, they look rebellious. That kid with his pants down at his hips, that looks rebellious. What's with them? Again, let's let Bible be Bible and let application of Bible be the application of Bible. Let specs be specs. And then let's realize that none of us want everyone nitpicking. We sure don't want God nitpicking. We sure don't want God nitpicking. Jesus talked about this in Matthew 23 with the Pharisees, that they strain a gnat and swallow a camel. It's wrong when critique centers on, again, matters of preference. But it's also wrong, we could say, whenever there is little or no self-examination. Whenever we go into rebuke or confrontation or even just critical comment, without first examining self, there is much danger for log hitting our brother in the head instead of us actually getting a speck out of his eye. Couldn't we say that judgment of others is at best dangerous when self-righteousness is allowed to kind of prosper in our life and we're not working at self-righteousness, rooting it out in our lives before and during and after we're confronting others? Again, this is a wrong view of God because we're competing with who is the judge here. You see, it can be a wrong view of God when we approach others in small, picky things, because God is slow to anger. And His mercy is, He's long-suffering. There can be a wrong view of others where we think that we're more important than them. It's a wrong view of self when we maybe start to play the judge with a capital J. Listen to how it's put in James 4. Verse 11, "Do not speak against one another, brethren. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge of it." You see, when you try to enforce the law on your brother or sister in Christ, you play lawgiver, and you place yourself not under the law as a fellow helper of doing the law, but you place yourself over that person as the law, and hence higher than the law itself. You're competing with Jesus. There is one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and to destroy. Who are you to judge your neighbor? These words should make us shut up sometimes. These words should give us much caution about our words. But don't miss what the goal is. Words. Helping a brother. Again, at the end of verse 42, get the log out of your eye and you can help him see the speck, help him remove the speck from his own eye. None of us have perfect vision of ourselves or of others. This passage is not telling us you better get perfect before you speak. It kind of sounds like that, get the log out of your own eye, but it didn't talk about how we all have cotton balls in our eyes, and little specks here and there, and little pieces of lint here and there. Our eyes are not perfectly seeing of ourselves or of others. What that means is when we do confront, we have a suspicion that we might be wrong, that our vision might be off, that there might be a log in our eye skewing our vision. But it doesn't mean we can never speak unless we're perfect, because you won't be perfect. Until heaven, you will not be perfect. You will have stuff in your eyes. So, you're going to have to talk as a fellow speckled eye guy. You're going to have to acknowledge the fact that you're fellow servants under the King, and you're there to help, not to lord over, not in any way in a spirit of superiority, but in a way of servantry in a way that you would want to be helped. I want my good friends to tell me when my fly's down. I want my good friends to tell me if I got a floater booger in my nose. I can't believe when I go home sometimes in the afternoon, I've been at church, just came from a meeting, and Sarah looks at me and she goes, oh, you got a little something right there. And I think, oh, I was just with so-and-so. Why didn't they tell me? Come on. A good friend will tell you. And you're not mad at it. You don't go, well, who are you to judge nostrils? I bet you have some in there too. I just can't see them. Kidding? We want to be helped. But with sin, we get defensive, unfortunately. We say, who are you to look at my specs? Who are you to look at my eyes? These are my eyes, and you got stuff too. Well, we want to be helped if we're honest with ourselves and with the Spirit and with God's work in our lives. And so it's a false humility to think that we're always inadequate to point out others' sin unless we have no sin. Oftentimes, it's an excuse for just being spineless. So the goal of this passage, the last thing Jesus says about this parable, is, yes, examine yourself painfully, surgically remove nasty things that are in your head so that you can help others. So that you can have less sin. Yes, that's important. So that you're less a hypocrite. Yes, that's important. And so that you can help them see themselves. Because we know when stuff's in our eye, we don't see so well. The pendulum keeps swinging. Many overuse and misuse this verse. Many people today, in the church and outside the church, say, oh, don't judge. So some of us, more maybe biblically careful type, like to point out that this passage actually has judgment in it. That judgment's all over the Bible, and we're supposed to be discerning, and we're supposed to know what's right and what's wrong, and we're supposed to do church discipline as a church. We're supposed to care enough to rebuke in love, not just love. And the pendulum has swung, perhaps over the other side, and somehow passage that says do not judge comes away emphasizing judge. That's not right. You lean towards one of these two extremes. Either you lean more towards wimpiness or you lean more towards boldness, wrong boldness. Neither is the goal. The more I think about this passage, the more I am cut to the heart with conviction for the many times that I have been a coward and I've called it love. Well, I didn't say anything because I care so much about him. Pat myself on the back. Feel good about myself. My tongue didn't get away from me that time. Yeah, your tongue didn't do anything. You're a wimp. Act like Jesus and call sin, sin. The more I think about this passage, the more I'm cut to the heart with conviction for all the times, on the other hand, that I've been a picky, small, self-righteous jerk and called it discernment. Called it boldness. Patted myself on the back that I had enough guts to be like Jesus who overturns tables in the temple. God help me. You know what's behind each of them? Self-justification. The same reason I don't want people in my business pointing out my specs is the exact same reason why I will feel pretty good at times about saying, that's bad, that's bad, that's bad. I just happen to be pointing out things that I'm pretty good at. Why? Because as I condemn those things, I justify myself. I feel better about myself. We lower our expectations in certain areas, kind of sweep them under the rug. And we raise these expectations about things we're actually decent in so that we can say, I'm good, I'm darn it, right with God. This is the same problem we've had from the beginning. You just see it in relationships like this where you don't want people to point anything out in your life. Why? Because you like feeling safe and secure. You like yourself justified. And you like to go to others at times, at other times, even if you're shy, even if you just do it in your head, even if you just do it with a couple people, pointing out specific things where you walk away saying, at least I'm not that poor fool. Just like Luke 18, the tax collector and the Pharisee praying at the wall, right down the way is the tax collector, the Pharisee saying, thank God I'm not like him. I pray, I fast. He doesn't do any of those things. Except he prays without looking side to side, not looking at people, looking up only at God. God, be merciful to me, a sinner. That man went home justified that day, not the Pharisee who did all those things, who dared compare himself to another, who judged another to justify self. Jesus, again, is the only answer. We must, whether you're not a Christian and you desire Christ's forgiveness and desire to be reconciled to God, or you are a Christian, you've been forgiven for years, but self-justification sneaks in ever so slightly from time to time, sometimes not so slightly, sometimes not that sneakily at all. The answer is the same. We run to Jesus, we forsake our self-preservation, we forsake our self-justification, we renounce it and hate it, and we flee to Jesus, who alone is our righteousness, whither alone is mercy. So, to be honest, I find myself quite perplexed with the tension that's in this passage. I wonder at what times I've been a wimp, and what times I've justified myself by judging another. Basically, all I know is that I've done both. It's hard pointing out which one's which. It's hard pointing out whether that rebuke was truly in love to you or whether that makes me feel good. It's really hard to point out, to see whether me saying nothing in examining self is just self-doubt in not wanting to mess with your problems so that later on in life you don't mess with my problems. So here's my conclusion for weeding through the complexity of that tension. Number one, pray. Pray for wisdom. James 1:5 says, if any man lacks wisdom, let him ask. Let him ask without wavering, and God will give it. You need wisdom to know when to shut up and do some eye x-rays. And when to quit focusing on your eyeball and love someone for Pete's sake. Confront them enough. Love them enough to confront them. Pray for wisdom to know which is which. Secondly, go to the Word. And stay in the Word because it's a mirror. Oh, sometimes the log prohibits a right view of yourself in the mirror. But pray, you'd get a glimpse. Pray, you'd see something. You need the mirror of the Word of God. That's why it's called a mirror. It reflects ourselves. In Hebrews 4, it talks about the Word of God being a sword that cuts us open and exposes hearts and motives. You need the Word to discern whether you're a jerk judge or a loving, caring brother. Let me quickly talk about the motivation, what drives all this. Just a few quick things. There are a few things in the passage itself which can also help us. I said pray for wisdom, go to the mirror, which is a word. Said that backwards. Go to the Word, which is a mirror. Let me give you some other things that hopefully can help undergird the obedience of this passage. To not judge, and yet to unhypocritically and lovingly at times go to our brother and say, brother, you have a speck. Let me help you. One, when it's motivated by God's love for us and his undeserved mercy toward us. That's what's in verse 35 and verse 36. that we can do our Father's work of showing mercy to those who don't deserve mercy. We can love those who don't deserve to be loved. But we love them as fellow sinners, as fellow eye problem, wood-laden people, to keep the analogy going. We go to them caring about eyes, to keep the analogy going, to care about the eradication of wood in this world, which is sin in this analogy. And because I care about my eyes and getting rid of wood in my life, and you care about your eyes and getting rid of wood in your life, we come together and we can help each other because we don't always see. And it won't be perfect. So we acknowledge as part of this that this is messy. It won't be perfect. Sometimes I'll say, "Hey, brother, is that a speck?" And you'll say, "No, it looks like a speck, but it's one of these floater things in your eye. Do you have those? I've got several floater things. It's like this black dot that floats around. I thought Star Wars was real when it first started happening, and I've seen things, but no, it's just this floater thing. And you can probably see, if you look under a microscope, that that's there. Well, it's not a speck. It's just part of my eye, I guess. Well, we ask. We want to help. But we do it motivated by God's love for us and in expression of His mercy toward us. We're people to whom God has not counted the specks, nor the logs. Jesus died for specks. Jesus died for the biggest of logs. Jesus died to purify eyes. Our eyes in Christ are now pure, even if they don't look like it. They will one day be ultimately pure in heaven. They will be restored. Our souls will be right and our hearts will be clean before Him. Completely so. In the meantime, I want to love those whom He has shown His love to. Secondly, we're motivated by a hatred of our own sin, a desire to see it less and less. It won't happen perfectly in this world, but we want less and less of it. We want to mortify the deeds of the flesh, Romans 8:13 says. It means putting to death, kill the deeds of sin. You have to keep doing it. Third, motivated by this call to unhypocritically help fellow disciples in their sin. Judging that's right is done in love. It's done to those who trust us. It's close up, isn't it? There's no eye speck noticing from a mile away. This takes some elbow rubbing. This takes some hugging. This takes closeness. It takes vulnerability. It takes the willingness to talk about that person's speck and know that that is an immediate invitation into your eyeball. Where they will later maybe say, "Well, I have something I need to talk to you about. I've got some questions I need to ask you about." And lastly, the motivation is the realization that all this can only come from a transformed heart. That's what we'll see in the weeks to come in the rest of this chapter. Look at verse 43. "There is no good tree which produces bad fruit, nor on the other hand a bad tree which produces good fruit." If all you know is self-preservation and then confrontational self-justification, then it may be that the Lord has not given you a new heart to believe and to be different. Pray that He would. It may be that you keep bearing bad fruit because the tree has not been made new. Pray that He would. Pray that God would help us as a church to do what He says here in Luke 6.